Today is Monday, February 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the death toll from the coronavirus has surpassed 900, with over 40,000 cases total worldwide.
This is up 15% from Saturday and breaks a string of daily declines.
Plus, voters in the U.S. state of New Hampshire head to the poll tomorrow in the first primary to select the next Democrat Party candidate for president. And a South Korean film makes history at the 2020 Academy Awards. Those stories and more are next. China has announced a rise in new virus cases, possibly lessening some of the optimism that the disease control measures, including isolating major cities, might be working. The AP's Charles de Ledesma starts us off.
The mainland death toll has now risen by 97 to just over 900 in the 24 hours through midnight Sunday, with over 3,000 new cases reported. This is up 15% from Saturday and breaks a string of daily declines. A government spokesman has said those declines showed containment measures were successful. Meanwhile, the operator of a cruise ship quarantined in Yokohama near Tokyo says an additional 66 cases were found aboard. This is in addition to 70 reported earlier.
In addition, De Ledesma reports Britain has declared the new coronavirus a serious and imminent threat to public health.
The Department of Health says people with the virus can now be forcibly quarantined and will not be free to leave. It named two British hospitals as isolation facilities for those affected by the disease and designated the Chinese city of Wuhan and a wider territory as an infected area. The shift in policy comes after a British man who caught the disease at a business conference in Singapore in January appears to be linked to at least seven other confirmed cases in Europe.
That was AP's Charles de Ledesma. An advanced team of international experts led by the World Health Organization has left for Beijing to help investigate China's coronavirus outbreak, while WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus returned from China in late January with an agreement on sending an international mission. It has taken nearly 2 weeks to get the government's green light on its composition. Dr. Bruce Alward, a Canadian epidemiologist and emergencies expert, will lead the team. The virus, which has spread to two dozen countries, has killed some 2% of those affected with it and 40,000 patients worldwide. The WHO reports that 99% of the infections are in China. The WHO declared the outbreak a global emergency on January 30th, days after the Chinese central government imposed a lockdown on 60 million people in Hubei province and its capital Wuhan, the epicenter of the virus. Officials say men armed with rifles and machetes attacked a police station in Benin near the border with Burkina Faso, raising fears that Islamic extremist violence could be encroaching even further south. One policeman was killed and another wounded in the attack in the village of Mekru Jimjim at dawn on Sunday, and the gunmen were set fire to the building, according to the police. The Philippine government's chief lawyer has asked the Supreme Court on Monday to shut down the country's largest TV network by revoking its operating franchise's license because of alleged constitutional violations, in a move critics called an attempt to muzzle the media. President Rodrigo Duterte has repeatedly attacked ABS-CBN, along with at least two other news agencies, for critical reporting about him, including his crackdown on illegal drugs that has left thousands of mostly poor suspects dead. Solicitor General Jose Calida said he filed the petition against the TV network and its subsidiary for abusing its franchises and violating a constitutional prohibition on foreign investment in Philippine media. ABS-CBN denied the allegations. Authorities in northern Thailand began releasing bodies to relatives Monday after security forces cornered and killed a soldier who carried out the country's worst mass shooting in a hours-long siege at a shopping mall. The soldier killed 29 people, starting with his commanding officer, in an incident that began Saturday and ended Sunday morning when security forces shot dead the heavily armed attacker. Authorities indicate the gunman was infuriated at a land deal brokered by his commander's mother-in-law, who was also among the victims. Tuesday's New Hampshire primary election will have a major impact on whom the Democrats nominate to run against U.S. President Donald Trump. VOA's Steve Reddish explains why the relatively tiny state has a huge role in electing a president of the United States.
Nothing is more etched in New Hampshire's Granite Mountains than the state's status holding the first presidential primary in an election year. State law mandates the primary election to be held at least 7 days before any other state holds its primary. By being first, New Hampshire has a reputation as a king maker and a king slayer. In 1952, Democratic Senator Estes Kefauver soundly beat President Harry Truman, who then decided not to run for re-election. Nestled in the Northeast U.S., New Hampshire ranks 45th in size and 41st in population. However, it does not reflect the nation's diversity. 93% of New Hampshire's 1.3 million people are white. Those voters fiercely defend their first-in-the-nation primary status by taking the time to meet candidates who start campaigning in New Hampshire a year before the primary. And yes, Iowa did cast the first votes earlier in February. But that was a caucus where political party members go to an evening meeting and publicly declare for a candidate. Primary voters cast secret ballots, and polls are open most of the day. And in New Hampshire, voting is not limited to just party members. Independents and even Republicans can vote in Tuesday's Democratic primary. Steve Reddish, VOA News.
Now, to break down things a little bit further on what things may mean for the current group of Democrat Party candidates in this year's contest to see who will be the nominee in November to take on President Trump in that election, I spoke with Matthew Kerbel, a political science professor at Villanova University.
Well, you know, New Hampshire is traditionally very important because it tends to set the race going forward. And I would agree with that, that this year it's going to be important as well, because we're going to get a sense of who can compete in New Hampshire and how effectively. But I want to qualify that by saying that this race is shaping up to be quite a bit different from previous races in the sense that no one appears to be dominating. And as a result of that, it's unlikely that New Hampshire is going to winnow the field tremendously. If you look at early tracking polls, you see pretty consistently Bernie Sanders is doing better than the other candidates, but at a very low level, about a 25% share of the vote. And that's not particularly high. So unless there's a surprise on Tuesday and Sanders or one of the other candidates surprisingly dominates the field, I really don't expect New Hampshire to winnow things down tremendously.
What about Joe Biden? You know, he called Iowa a gut punch. He alluded to the fact that he may not do as well in New Hampshire, but still calls himself, you know, the most electable out of the Democratic field.
Well, you know, I think if you want to claim electability, people have to vote for you. And it's quite possible that Biden will be stronger as we move forward into the primary contests, especially as the Democratic electorate becomes more diverse in some of the states ahead. On the other hand, to the extent that New Hampshire does structure the race, another poor showing by Biden, following his poor showing in Iowa, could be problematic for him.
You bring up how important New Hampshire is in setting the tone, but you also mentioned how, you know, the Democratic primaries will become more diverse. Iowa, and for that matter, New Hampshire, are not very diverse populations.
No, they're not. And that's specifically a problem for Biden in the sense that a good deal of his early support came from voters of color and still continues to. So having to compete in primaries where or caucuses where the population is almost entirely white obviously has come at some cost for Biden. But I'd have to believe that the Biden people still thought that they were going to do better in Iowa and New Hampshire than they did. And I think there were real warning signs early on about how well Biden is resonating as a candidate.
Looking at the primaries on Tuesday, what is the one thing you're looking for in terms of gauging how this is going to play out for the Democrats moving forward?
Well, it will be interesting to see if Iowa and New Hampshire track each other. In other words, to see if the order of finish in New Hampshire is in any way similar to what we saw in Iowa. If it is, The conclusion I would draw is that Democratic voters are still not yet ready to get behind a specific candidate.
That was political science professor Matthew Kerbel from Villanova University. And still to come,
the leader of El Salvador ramped up efforts to bolster police and soldiers in the fight against the country's notorious crime. The same violence that migrants say has pushed them to leave.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Many consider the smartphone a technological wonder. With it, you can communicate with family and friends, as well as listen to music, check the weather or latest news, and with built-in GPS, keep yourself from getting lost. What many would consider a good smartphone feature is a way for it to help keep yourself healthy. While most smartphone manufacturers are concerned with regulatory issues a feature like this would bring, scientists at the University of Cincinnati have developed a small phone add-on medical system that would be able to monitor and detect a number of health conditions. The scientists say that with just a single drop of blood or saliva on a custom lab chip, the device can diagnose infectious diseases or countless other health conditions. After gathering diagnostic data, the device then automatically transmits the information to a doctor. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Indonesia's President Joko Widodo had the rare honor Monday of addressing a joint sitting of the Australian Federal Parliament. Phil Mercer reports the presidential visit is a chance for Australia and its neighbor to reset relations following spy scandals, tensions over asylum seekers, and the executions of two Australian drug traffickers.
Relations between Australia and its large Muslim-majority neighbour to the north have improved markedly in recent years. President Joko Widodo's address marked 70 years of bilateral ties. He's only the second Indonesian leader to speak before a joint sitting of the Australian Parliament. Economic development and attracting foreign investment are key priorities for Widodo. Last week, the Indonesian Parliament ratified a free trade agreement with Australia. The President told the Federal Parliament in Canberra that his country is helping Australia with its recovery from a long and devastating bushfire season. Australia's two-way trade with Indonesia is worth about $11 billion. The new free trade deal will wipe out almost all tariffs on exports to both countries. Australian Trade Minister Simon Birmingham says it's a good result for many sectors.
Around 500,000 tonnes of grain, a huge boom, particularly for our West Australian grain growers. Big opportunities in terms of the cattle trade, the horticulture trade, but also in the services space, enormous potential in terms of now new opportunities for Australian education providers, our universities and vocational education providers to operate in Indonesia.
Cooperation on climate change is another area that's expected to benefit from closer ties. The two countries already work closely on terrorism and the response to natural disasters. Successive Australian leaders have sought to forge better relations with Jakarta. But this enthusiasm appears not to be shared by Australians. A poll from the Lowy Institute, a Sydney-based think tank, in 2019 found only 1% of Australians felt Indonesia was Australia's best friend in the world. Canberra is being urged to raise the cases of members of an Australian drug gang caught trying to smuggle heroin out of Bali, Indonesia, in April 2005. Five members of the syndicate are serving life sentences in Indonesia. Two others of the so-called Bali Nine were executed. Convicted drug smuggler Rene Lawrence, another member of the gang who was released in 2018, has used Widodo's visit to plead for reduced sentences for those who remain behind bars. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
El Salvador's president has called on his supporters to join him in pressuring lawmakers to approve a loan to boost security and police to fight crime in the country. Reuters' Libby Hogan has that story.
The leader of El Salvador ramped up efforts to bolster police and soldiers in the fight against the country's notorious crime. The same violence that migrants say has pushed them to leave. President Nayib Bukele is pressuring lawmakers to approve a loan of over $1 million. On Sunday, Bukele summoned his supporters to demonstrate outside the Capitol building. Waving banners and blowing whistles, they answered Bukele's calls.
Blood is on their hands, without shame. This loan was from last year. The funds were due to be applied to our police and soldiers.
But human rights group Amnesty International called the introduction of armed soldiers by Bukele in the parliament an unnecessary military presence and raises international alarm over the future of human rights in the country. The murder rate in El Salvador declined last year, but authorities continue to battle gangs that control vast swaths of land. Bukele supporter Douglas Molina pointed the finger at lawmakers.
We have come out in support so that those who are corrupt can be removed from the Legislative Assembly.
The 38-year-old president promised a new era when he was elected and pledged to reduce the number of young people joining gangs. Bukele said he won't back down unless Congress acts. And if the standoff continues, he told the crowd they'd gather again next week.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. Canadian police are expected to raid a protest camp at a health center in British Columbia where Indigenous people from the Wet'suwet'en tribe have been blocking construction of a natural gas pipeline for months. Police have arrested 20 people since they began evicting protesters last week after a Canadian court ruled in favor of the TC Energy Corporation to continue with a $6.6 billion project. The arrests have sparked protests in support of the Wet'suwet'en tribe across Canada, according to the Globe and Mail newspapers. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke with journalist Jesse Winter in Vancouver, who's been covering the protests. He first explained why the protesters were blocking the pipeline.
They're against it because they say that this particular piece of land is one of the last truly untouched pieces of their traditional territory. There's a ton of forestry work that goes on in northern BC and in this area, but this particular piece has always been untouched, and they say it needs to remain that way because it's critical not just for their traditions and culture, but for the wildlife that they rely on. They're really, really uncomfortable with the idea of there being a work camp with hundreds of workers very, very close by and resource workers driving up and down the roads.
What has happened with the court order that was handed down last week or the court ruling that was handed down last week, and how has that led to the latest evictions and arrests?
When it was granted in January last year, it was an interim injunction that prevented anyone from occupying or blocking Coastal GasLink's access to the land to do construction or pre-construction work, which is what they want to be doing right now. That move prompted the hereditary chiefs to evict Coastal GasLink from their territory. And that's when you started to see the blockades going back up. And since early January, it's been a very, very tense situation. We knew that this sort of enforcement action was very likely.
What does it look like is going to happen next with the police action that is apparently taking place now or soon to take place today?
Well, they arrived yesterday at the Unistoten Healing Lodge. The police arrived there yesterday with bulldozers. They cleared the road all the way up to the gate. Today, I would expect that they will probably try and negotiate for some amount of time. Last year at the barricades, they spent a few hours negotiating through the barbed wire, trying to get the chiefs and their supporters to stand down. I think that's probably very unlikely. So at some point, they're probably going to have to break that gate down. And then they have a very, very difficult decision on their hands. And whether the police are willing to drag Indigenous elders out of a $2.1 million healing center, that's going to be a very careful set of decisions the police are going to have to make about what they're willing to do. And it's not just a protest camp. It is definitely a healthcare facility. It's going to be probably a very long, intense day for everybody there.
This has stirred up a lot of emotion across Canada. There have been protests in various cities. What's going on with that?
Well, there were a couple of protest positions set up. Two here in the sort of the lower mainland area around Vancouver. One blocking the Port of Vancouver, which is a huge shipping port, that had been in place for several days. And my understanding, police began making arrests there at about 5 a.m. this morning. There was also a blockade at Delta Port, which is another big shipping facility about 45 minutes drive south of Vancouver. We've seen Mohawk, the Tiendanega Nation in Ontario, blocking rail lines earlier this week. They disrupted for several days, disrupted rail traffic. Yeah, there have been marches in Ottawa, Toronto. We've reached a moment, I think, where in a general sense, people recognize that something's got to change. And there's been a lot of talk from a lot of politicians about the need to reconcile and the need to develop better structures and better ways of making decisions that are more inclusive of Indigenous perspectives. But we still just haven't changed it yet. And I think that tension, that frustration is finally starting to boil over for a lot of people.
That was reporter Jesse Winter speaking to my VOA colleague, Jason Patinkin. It's the yearly Hollywood bash that brings out all the glitz and glamour one conjures to mind when you think of Tinseltown. It was a year of firsts that saw the South Korean film Parasite win not only the Oscar for Best International Film, but became the first non-English language movie to win the coveted Best Picture Prize. For more on last night's big event, I spoke to VOA Upfront and Red Carpet host Jackson Vunganyi.
Let's start with the red carpet. Lots of fashion statements on the red carpet, too. Actress Natalie Portman using the moment to take a thorough dig at the Academy for what many say was a lack of recognition for female directors. As we know, Steve, more women made movies in 2019 than at any other time in film history.
Well, it's not just the Academy. Remember back in the Golden Globes, not a single female was nominated for a top spot either.
Absolutely. And Natalie Portman used that moment on the red carpet to speak through fashion. You know, she embroidered the names of female directors on her dress, you know, directors like Greta Gerwig, Lulu Wang, and many others who were snapped by the Academy. I also should mention real quick that on the red carpet, this is where they, you know, make these different fashion statements. Director Spike Lee used this moment, his moment on the red carpet, to pay tribute to Kobe Bryant. He embroidered the number 24, the jersey for Kobe Bryant on his jacket.
So running down some of the winners, we saw the Parasite won Best Picture, not only for foreign language film, but for Best Picture overall. Brad Pitt for Best Supporting Actor Upon a Time for Hollywood. His first Oscar, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, when you think about Brad Pitt and his legendary career here in Hollywood, I mean, this man has had such a career, great movies, and he was finally recognized. Many people did not know that he had actually has never won an Oscar before, and he won for his role in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Parasite indeed made history, the first non-English film to win Best Picture at the Oscars. It was the first Korean film nominated for Best Picture, let alone winning. And so many say that this was a redemptive moment for the Academy, having been criticized for its lack of diversity. It was also a great night for director Bong Joon-ho.
What else stood out in your mind as you were there on the red carpet and covering this event?
Let's talk about Netflix. Netflix was a game changer in Hollywood and the whole film industry. It came in with 24 nominations, more than any other studio. Actress Laura Dern, who was one of three family members who was nominated, she won for Best Supporting Actress for Marriage Story, making it the first time a Netflix movie earned an acting Oscar. Another Netflix film, American Factory, the documentary produced by Michelle and Barack Obama's production company, they won for Best Feature Documentary. So we see that Netflix is slowly becoming this platform that produces great original content, and that the Academy is acknowledging that.
That was VOA's Jackson Vunganyi speaking to me from Hollywood, California. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Dan Brown, and engineer, John Dryden, thank you very much for joining us. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.